he said. Hester hates me.
Nonsense, giggled Miss Fang. She likes you very much. Did she not spend half the night telling me how kind you have been, and how wonderfully brave you were, killing that machine man?
Did she? Tom blushed, feeling suddenly proud. He didn't think he would ever get used to Hester Shaw and her seesawing moods. Nevertheless, she was the closest thing he had to a friend in this huge, confusing world, and he still remembered how she had pleaded with Shrike for his life. Wherever she was going, he had to go too, even into the savage heartland of the League, even to Shan Guo.
All right, he said.
I'll come.
Chapter 25 The Historians. It is raining on London, steady rain out of the low, bruised sky. Raining hard enough to wash away the snow and churn the mud beneath the city's tracks into thick yellow slurry, but not to quench the fires of Panzerstadt Bayreuth, which are still blazing like a Titan's pyre away in the northwest. Magnus Krohm stands on the windswept roof of the Engineerium and watches the rising smoke. An apprentice holds an umbrella over him, and behind her wait six tall, motionless figures, dressed in black versions of the Guild's rubber coats. The terrorists who breached the Engineerium last night have still not been caught, and security is being strengthened. From now on, the Lord Mayor will go nowhere without his new bodyguard, the first batch of Dr. Twix's stalkers. A Guild spotter ship swings overhead and touches down. Dr. Vambrace, the engineer's security chief, steps out and comes hurrying to where the Lord Mayor waits, his rubber coat flapping thickly in the wind.
"Well, Doctor?" Krohm asks eagerly. "What did you see? Were you able to land?"
Vambrace shakes his head.
"Fires are still burning all over the wreck, but we circled as low as we dared and took photographs. The upper tiers have melted and collapsed onto the lower, and it looks as if all the boilers and fuel stores exploded at the first touch of our energy beam."
Krohm nods.
"Were there any survivors?"
"A few signs of life between the tiers, but otherwise..."
The security man's eyes go wide behind his thick glasses, looking like a pair of jellyfish in an aquarium. His department is always keen to find new and inventive ways to kill people, and he is still excited at the thought of the dry, charred shapes he saw littering the streets and squares of Panzerstadt Bayreuth, many of them still standing upright, flashed into clinker statues by the gaze of Medusa.
"Do you intend to turn back and devour the wreck, Lord Mayor?"
he asks after a moment.
"The fires will burn themselves out in a day or two."
"Absolutely not," snaps Krohm. "We must press on toward the shield wall."
"The people will not like that," Vambrace warns. "They have had their victory. Now they want the spoils, the scrap metal and spare parts from that conurbation."
"I have not brought London all this way for scrap metal and spare parts," Krohm interrupts.
He stands at the handrail on the roof's rim and stares east. He can already see the white summits of high mountains on the horizon, like a row of pearly teeth.
"We must press on. A few more days will bring us within range of the shield wall. I have announced a public holiday and a reception at the Guild Hall to mark the great event. Think of it, Vambrace. A whole new hunting ground."
"But the League knows we are coming now," warns Vambrace. "They will try to stop us."
Krohm's eyes are bright and cold, gazing at the future. He says,
"Valentine has his orders. He will deal with the League."
And so London kept moving, dragging itself eastward as the smoke of the dead conurbation towered up into the sky behind, and Catherine walked to the elevator stations through the wet wreckage of last night's celebrations.
broken Chinese lanterns blew across the shuddering deck plates, and men in the red livery of the recycling department wheeled bins around, gathering up abandoned party hats and soggy banners whose messages were still dimly to be read. We Heart Magnus Chrome, and Long Live London. Dog played chase with a billowing paper chain, but Catherine called him sharply to heel. This was no time for games. At least in the museum there were no banners and no paper chains. The Historians Guild had never been as quick as the rest of London to welcome new inventions from the engineers, and they made no exception for Medusa. In the dusty shadows of the exhibition galleries there was a decent silence, as befitted the mourning after the death of a whole city. The sounds of the streets outside seemed muffled, as if thick, soft curtains of time hung in the dim air between the display cabinets. The quietness helped Catherine to gather her thoughts, and by the time she reached Chudley Pomeroy's office, she was quite clear about what she had to say. She had not yet told Mr. Pomeroy what she had learned in the engineerium, but he had seen how shaken she was when he left her at Clio House the night before. He did not seem surprised to find her and Dog at his door.
"Mr. Pomeroy," she whispered, "I have to talk to you. Is Bevis here? Is he all right?"
"Of course," he said at once. "Come in."
Bevis Pod was waiting for her in the little teak-panelled office, dressed in borrowed historian's robes, his pale skull looking as fragile as an eggshell in the dim yellow glow of the museum lamps. She wanted to run to him and hold him and apologize for what she had led him into, but crammed in around him were about a dozen historians, some perching on the arms of chairs and the corners of Pomeroy's desk. They all looked up guiltily at Catherine, and she looked back at them with a sudden, horrible fear that Pomeroy had betrayed her.
"Don't worry," said Pomeroy kindly. "If Pod's to be a guest of the museum, I thought my fellow historians should be introduced to him. None of us are friends of the Lord Mayor. We have agreed that Apprentice Pod can stay as long as necessary."
The historians made a space for her next to Bevis.
"Are you all right?"
she asked him, and was relieved when he managed a nervous smile.
"Not bad,"
he whispered.
"It's strange here. All this wood everywhere, and old stuff. But the historians are very kind."
Catherine looked around the room at them. She knew many of them by sight. Dr. Arkengarth, Dr. Karuna, Professor Pewtertide, young Miss Potts, Norman Nancarrow from Prints and Paintings, and Miss Plym, who was sniffling into her hanky.
"We've been talking about the destruction of Panzerstadt by Reut," said Pomeroy, pressing a hot mug of cocoa into her hands. "This horrible Medusa device."
"Everybody else seems to think it's wonderful," said Catherine bitterly. "I could hear them laughing and shouting good old Chrome half the night. I know they're relieved that we didn't get eaten, but, well, I don't think blowing up another city is anything to be happy about."
"It's a disaster,"
agreed old Dr. Arkengarth, wringing his bony hands.
"The vibrations from that vile machine played havoc with my ceramics." "Oh, bother your ceramics, Arkengarth," snapped Pomeroy, who could see how upset Catherine was. "What about Panzerstadt by Reut, burned to a cinder?"
"That's what comes of the engineer's obsession with old tech," said Professor Pewtertide. "Countless centuries of history to learn from, and all they're interested in is a few ancient machines."
"And what did the ancients ever achieve with their devices anyway?"
whined Arkengarth.
"They just made a horrible mess of their world and then blew themselves up."
The others nodded dolefully.
"There was a great museum in Panzerstadt by Reut," said Dr. Karuna.
"I believe they had some wonderful paintings,"
agreed Nancarrow.
"Unique examples of 13th-century cabinet-making,"
wailed Miss Plym, and collapsed in tears on Arkengarth's knobbly shoulder.
"You must excuse poor Moira, Catherine,"
whispered Pomeroy.
She had terrible news this morning. Chrome has ordered that our furniture collection be broken up to feed the furnaces. It's the fuel shortage, you see, a result of this mad journey east.
Catherine couldn't have cared less about furniture or ceramics at that moment, but she felt glad that she was not the only one in London appalled by what the Lord Mayor had unleashed. She took a deep breath, then quickly explained what she and Bevis had heard in the Engineerium about Medusa and the next step in Chrome's great plan, the attack on the shield wall.
"But that's terrible," they whispered when she had finished. "Shenguo is a great and ancient culture. Anti-traction league or no anti-traction league, Batmunk Gompa can't be blown up.
Think of all those temples.
Oh, ceramics.
Prayer wheels.
Silk paintings.
Furniture.
Think of the people," said Catherine angrily.
"We must do something."
Yes, yes,
they agreed, and then all looked sheepishly at her. After 20 years of Chrome's rule, they had no idea how to stand up to the Guild of Engineers.
"But what can we do?"
asked Pomeroy at last.
"Tell people what is happening," urged Catherine. "You're acting head historian. Call a meeting of the council. Make them see how wrong it is."
Pomeroy shook his head.
"They won't listen, Miss Valentine. You heard the cheering last night."
"But that was only because Panzerstadt Bayreuth had been going to eat us. When they learn that Chrome plans to turn his weapon on yet another city..."
"They'll just cheer all the louder," sighed Pomeroy.
"He has packed the other guilds with his allies anyway," observed Dr. Karuna. "All the great old guildsmen are gone. Dead or retired or arrested on his orders. Even our own apprentices are as besotted with old tech as the engineers, especially since Chrome foisted his man Valentine on us as head historian. Oh, I mean no offence, Miss Catherine."
"Father isn't Chrome's man," said Catherine angrily. "I'm sure he's not. If he knew what Chrome was planning, he would never have helped him. That's probably why he was packed off on this reconnaissance mission, to get him out of the way. When he gets home and finds out, he'll do something to stop it. You see, it was he who found Medusa in the first place. He would be horrified to think of it killing all those people. He will want to make amends. I'm sure he will."
She spoke so passionately that some of the historians believed her, even the ones like Dr. Karuna, who had been passed over for promotion when Chrome put Valentine in charge of their guild. As for Bevis Pod, he watched her with shining eyes, filled with a feeling that he couldn't even name, something that they had never taught him about in the learning labs. It made him shiver all over. Pomeroy was the first to speak.
"I hope you're right, Miss Valentine," he said. "Because he is the only man who can hope to challenge the Lord Mayor. We must wait for his return.
But
in the meantime, we have agreed to keep Mr. Pod safe here at the museum. He can sleep up in the old transport gallery and help Dr. Nancarrow catalogue the art collection. And if the engineers come hunting for him, we'll find a hiding place. It isn't much of a blow against Chrome, I know, but please understand, Catherine, we are old and frightened, and there really is nothing more that we can do."
Chapter 26 Batmunk Gompa. The world was changing. That was nothing new, of course. The first thing an apprentice historian learned was that the world was always changing. But now it was changing so fast that you could actually see it happening. Looking down from the flight deck of the Jenny Hanover, Tom saw the wide plains of the Eastern Hunting Ground speckled with speeding towns, spurred into flight by whatever it was that had bruised the northern sky, heading away from it as fast as their tracks or wheels could carry them, too preoccupied to try and catch one another.
"Medusa,"
he heard Miss Fang whisper to herself, staring toward the far-off, flame-flecked smoke.
"What is a Medusa?" asked Hester. "You know something, don't you? About what my mum and dad were killed for?" "I'm afraid not," the aviatrix replied. "I wish I did, but I heard the name once. 6 years ago, another League agent managed to get into London, posing as a crewman on a licensed airship. He had heard something that must have intrigued him, but we never learned what it was. The League had only one message from him, just two words. Beware Medusa. The engineers caught him and killed him."
"How do you know?" asked Tom.
"Because they sent us back his head," said Miss Fang. "Cash on delivery."
That evening she set the Jenny Hannifer down on one of the fleeing towns, a respectable four-decker called Peripatetiapolis that was steering south to lair in the mountains beyond the Sea of Kazak. At the air harbour there, they heard more news of what had happened to Panzerstadt Bayreuth.
"I saw it," said an aviator. "I was 100 miles away, but I still saw it. A tongue of fire reaching out from London's top tier and bringing death to everything it touched."
"London's dug up something from the 60-minute war," a freelance archaeologist told them. "The old American Empire was quite insane toward the end. I've heard stories about terrible weapons. Quantum energy beams that drew their power from places outside the real universe.
Who'll dare defy them now, when Magnus Chrome has the power to burn any city that disobeys him?"
asked a panic-stricken Peripatetiapolitan merchant.
"Come here and let us eat you, London will tell us, and we will have to go. It's the end of civilization as we know it, again."
But one good thing had come out of it. The people of Peripatetiapolis were suddenly quite glad to accept Tom's London money. On an impulse, he bought a red silk shawl to replace the scarf that Hester had lost on that long-ago night when he chased her through the gut.
"For me?"
she said incredulously when he gave it to her. She couldn't remember anyone ever giving her a gift before. She had not spoken to him much since they left the Black Island, ashamed of her outburst the night before, but now she said,
"Thank you, and I suppose I should thank you for saving my life, too, though I don't know why you keep bothering." "I knew you didn't really want to end up as a stalker," Tom told her.
"Oh, I did," she said.
"It would make things so much easier, but you did the right thing."
She looked away from him, embarrassed, staring down at the shawl in her hands.
"I try to be nice," she said. "Nobody's ever made me feel they like me before, the way you do. So I try to be kind and smiley, like you want me to be, but then I catch sight of my reflection, or I think of him, and it all goes wrong, and I can only think horrible things and scream at you and try and hurt you. I'm sorry."
"It's all right," said Tom awkwardly. "I know. It's okay."
He picked up the shawl and tied it carefully around her neck. But as he had expected, she pulled it up at once to hide her mouth and nose. He felt strangely sad. He had grown used to that face, and he would miss her lopsided smiles. They flew on before dawn, crossing a range of steep hills like crumpled brown paper. All day the land rose up and up, and soon Tom realized that they were leaving the hunting ground altogether. By evening the Jenny Hannifer was flying over landscapes too rugged for most towns to travel. He saw dense forests of pine and rhododendron, with now and then a little static village squatting in its cove of farmland, and once a white settlement perched on a mountain top with roads reaching out from it like the spokes of a wheel. Real roads, with carts moving up and down, and a bright flutter of prayer flags at the intersections. He watched until they were out of sight. He had heard about roads in his history lessons, but he had never thought he'd see one. Next day, Anna Fang handed out balls of reddish paste to her passengers.
"Powdered betel nut," she explained, "mixed with some dried leaves from Nuevo Maya. They help at these high altitudes, but don't make a habit of chewing them, or your teeth will turn as red as mine."
The gritty paste made Tom's mouth tingle, but it cured the faint sense of nausea and lightheadedness that had been growing in him as the airship flew higher and higher, and it also helped to numb the pain of his broken ribs. By now, the Jenny's tiny shadow was flickering over high, snow-clad summits, and ahead lay summits still higher, white spires that hung like a mirage above the clouds. Beyond them stretched an even higher range, and then another higher yet. Tom strained his eyes, peering toward the south, in the hope that he might catch a glimpse of old Chomolungma, Everest of the ancients. But storms were brewing in the high Himalayas, and it was wrapped in cloud. On and on they flew, through a black-and-white world of snow and glaciers and the sheer dark rock of young mountains, where Tom or Hester sometimes had to mind the controls while Anna Fang took catnaps in the seat beside them, afraid to risk leaving her flight deck. And still they climbed, until at last they were skimming over the low buttresses of great Zan Shan, tallest of the Earth's new mountains, whose snow-capped crown jutted into the endless cold above the sky. After that, the peaks were lower, white and lovely, with sometimes a green veil between, where huge herds of animals scattered and wheeled at the sound of the airship's engines. These were the mountains of heaven, and they swept away toward the north and east and sank down in the far distance to steppe and taiga and the glitter of impassable swamps.
"This is Shan Guo of the Many Horses," Anna Fang told Tom and Hester. "I had hoped to retire here when my work for the League was done. Now I suppose it may all be eaten by London, our fortresses blasted by Medusa and our settlements devoured, the green hills split open and made to give up their minerals, the horses extinct, just like the rest of the world."
Tom didn't think it was such a bad idea, because it was only natural that traction cities should eventually spread right across the globe. But he couldn't help liking Miss Fang, even if she was a spy and an anti-tractionist, and to comfort her, he said,
"However powerful Medusa is, it will take years for London to gnaw its way through these great big mountains."
"It won't have to," she replied. "Look."
He looked where she pointed and saw a break in the mountain chain ahead, a broad pass that a city could have crawled along, except that stretching across it, so vast that it seemed at first glance just another spur of the mountains, was the Shield Wall. It was like a wall of night, black, black, built from huge blocks of volcanic stone, armored with the rusting deckplates of cities that had dared to challenge it and been destroyed by the hundreds of rocket batteries on its western face. On its snow-clad summit, 4,000 feet above the valley floor, the banner of the Broken Wheel snapped and raced in the wind, and the sunlight gleamed on armored gun emplacements and the steel helmets of the League's soldiers.
"If only it were as strong as it looks," sighed the aviatrix, bringing the Jenny Hanover down toward it in a long sweeping curve.
A small flying machine, little more than a motorized kite, came soaring to meet them, and she held a brief radio conversation with its pilot. It circled the Jenny once, and then whirred ahead, guiding the newcomer over the top of the shield wall. Tom looked down at broad battlements and the faces of soldiers gazing upward, yellow, brown, black, white, faces from every part of the world where barbarian statics still held out against municipal Darwinism. Then they were gone. The Jenny was sinking down the sheltered eastern side of the wall, and he saw that it was a city, a vertical city, with hundreds of terraces and balconies and windows all carved into the black rock, tier upon tier of shops and barracks and houses with balloons and brightly coloured kites drifting up and down between them like petals. "Bat Munk Gompa," announced Miss Fang, "the city of eternal strength, although the people who call it that have never heard of Medusa, of course." It was beautiful. Tom, who had always been taught that static settlements were dingy, squalid, backward places, went to the window and stared, and Hester came and pressed her face to the glass beside him, safe behind her veil and almost girlish.
"Oh, it's just like the cliffs on Oak Island, where the seabirds nest," she cried. "Look, look!"
Down at the base of the wall, a lake shone azure blue, flecked with the sails of pleasure boats.
"Tom, we'll go swimming. I'll teach you how."
The Jenny Hanover landed among some other merchant ships at a mooring terrace halfway down the wall, and Miss Fang led Tom and Hester to a waiting balloon that took them up again past parks and tea shops to the Governor's Palace. The ancient monastery from which Bat Munk Gompa took its name, whitewashed and many-windowed, carved out of the steep side of the mountain at the wall's end. Other balloons were converging on the landing deck below the palace gardens, their envelopes bright in the mountain sunlight. And in one of the dangling baskets, Tom saw Captain Cora waving. They met on the landing deck, the young airman touching down just ahead of them and running across to embrace Miss Fang and help her friends out of the skittish gondola. He had flown here from Airhaven the morning after Shrike's attack, and he seemed amazed and happy to see Tom and Hester alive. Turning to the aviatrix, he said,
"The Governor and his officers are eager for your report, Fung Hua. Terrible rumors have reached us about London."
It was good to meet a friendly face in this strange new city, and Tom fell into step beside Cora as he led the newcomers up the long stair to the palace entrance. He remembered seeing a trim Achebe 2100 berthed at one of the lower platforms, and asked,
"Was that your machine we saw at the mooring place, the one with oxhide outriggers?"
Cora laughed delightedly.
"That old air scow? No, thank the gods. My Makile Mbembe is a warship, Tom. Every ally of the League supplies a ship to the Northern Air Fleet, and they are stabled together up there."
He stopped and pointed, and Tom saw the gleam of bronze doors far up near the summit of the wall.
The High Eyries.
"We'll take you up there one day, Tom,"
promised Miss Fang, leading them past the warrior monks who guarded the door and on into a maze of cool stone corridors.
"The League's great air destroyers are one of the wonders of the skies. But first, Governor Khan must hear Hester's story."
Governor Ermine Khan was a gentle old man with the long, mournful face of a kindly sheep. He welcomed them all into his private quarters and gave them tea and honey cakes in a room whose round windows looked down toward the lake of Bat Munk Noor, gleaming among patchwork farmlands far below. For 1,000 years his family had helped to man the shield wall, and he seemed dazed by the news that all his guns and rockets were suddenly useless.
"No city can pass Bat Munk Gompa,"
he kept saying, as the room filled with officers eager to hear the aviatrix's advice.
"My dear Fung Hua, if London dares to approach us, we will destroy it. As soon as it comes in range, a boom."
"But that is what I'm trying to tell you," cried Miss Fang impatiently. "London doesn't need to come within range of your guns. Chrome will park his city 100 miles away and burn your precious wall to ashes. You have heard Hester's story. I believe that the machine Valentine stole from her mother was a fragment of an ancient weapon. And what happened to Panzerstadt Bayreuth proves that the Guild of Engineers have managed to restore it to working order."
"Yes, yes," said an artillery officer. "So you say. but can we really believe that Chrome has found a way to reactivate something that has been buried since the 60-minute war? Perhaps Panzerstadt Bayreuth was just destroyed by a freak accident.
Yes, Governor Kahn clutched gratefully at the idea. A meteorite, or some sort of gas leak.
He stroked his long beard, reminding Tom of one of the dithery old historians back at the London Museum.
Perhaps Chrome's city will not even come here. Perhaps he has other prey in mind.
But his other officers were more ready to believe the Windflower's report.
"She's coming here all right," said one, an aviatrix from Kerala, not much older than Tom. "I took a scout ship west the day before yesterday, Fung Hua," she explained, with an adoring look at Miss Fang. "The barbarian city was less than 500 miles away, and approaching fast. By tomorrow night, Medusa could be within range."
"And there have been sightings of a black airship in the mountains," put in Captain Cora. "The ships sent to intercept it never returned. My guess is that it was Valentine's 13th floor elevator sent to spy out our cities so that London can devour them."
Valentine. Tom felt a strange mix of pride and fear at the thought of the head historian on the loose here in the very heart of Shanguo. Beside him, Hester tensed at the mention of the explorer's name. He looked at her, but she was staring past him, out through the open windows, toward the mountains, as if she half expected to see the 13th floor elevator go flying past.
"No city can pass the shield wall," said Governor Kahn, loyal to his ancestors,
but he did not sound convinced any more.
"You must launch the air fleet, Governor,"
Miss Fang insisted, leaning forward in her seat.
"Bomb London before they can bring Medusa into range. It's the only way to be sure."
"No!" shouted Tom, springing up so that his chair fell backward with a clatter. He couldn't believe what she had said.
"You said we were coming here to warn people. You can't attack London. People will get hurt. Innocent people."
He was thinking of Catherine, imagining League torpedoes crashing into Clio House and the museum.
"You promised," he said weakly. "Fung Hua does not make promises to savages,"
snapped the Kerolan girl, but Miss Fang hushed her.
"We will just hit the gut and tracks, Tom," she said. "Then the top tier, where Medusa is housed. We do not seek to harm the innocent. But what else are we to do if a barbarian city chooses to threaten us?"
"London's not a barbarian city," shouted Tom. "It's you who are the barbarians. Why shouldn't London eat Batmunk Gompa if it needs to?
If you don't like the idea, you should have put your cities on wheels long ago, like civilized people."
A few of the League officers were shouting angrily at him to be quiet, and the Kerolan girl had drawn her sword, but Miss Fang calmed them with a few words and turned her patient smile to Tom.
"Perhaps you should leave us, Thomas," she said firmly. "I will come and find you later."
Tom's eyes stung with stupid tears. He was sorry for these people, of course he was. He could see that they weren't savages, and he didn't really believe any more that they deserved to be eaten. But he couldn't just sit by and listen to them planning to attack his home. He turned to Hester in the hope that she would take his side. But she was lost in her own thoughts, her fingers tracing and retracing the scars under her red veil. She felt guilty and stupid. Guilty because she had been happy in the air with Tom, and it was wrong to be happy while Valentine was wandering about unpunished. Stupid because when he gave her the shawl, she had started to hope that Tom really liked her, and thinking of Valentine made her remember that nobody could like her, not in that way, not ever. When she saw him looking at her, she just said,
"They can kill everybody in London for all I care, so long as they save Valentine for me."
Tom turned his back on her and stalked out of the high chamber, and as the door rolled shut behind him, he heard the Kerolan girl hiss,
barbarian.
Alone, he mooched down to the terrace, where the taxi balloons waited, and sat on a stone bench there, feeling angry and betrayed, and thinking of things that he should have said to Miss Fang if only he had thought of them in time. Below him, the rooftops and terraces of Bat Munk Gompa stretched away into the shadows below the white shoulders of the mountains, and he found himself trying to imagine what it must be like to live here and wake up every day of your life to the same view. Didn't the people of the Shield Wall long for movement and a change of scene? How did they dream without the grumbling vibrations of a city's engines to rock them to sleep? Did they love this place? And suddenly he felt terribly sad that the whole bustling, colourful, ancient city might soon be rubble under London's tracks. He wanted to see more. Going over to the nearest taxi balloon, he made the pilot understand that he was Miss Fang's guest and wanted to go down into the city. The man grinned and started weighting his gondola with stones from a pile that stood nearby, and soon Tom found himself travelling down past the many levels of the city again until he stepped out on a sort of central square, where dozens of other taxis were coming and going, and stairways branched off across the face of the shield wall, going up toward the high eyries and down to the shops and markets of the lower levels. News of Medusa was spreading fast through Bat Munk Gompa, and already a lot of the houses and shops were shuttered, their owners fled to cities farther south. The lower levels were still packed with people, though, and as the sun dipped behind the wall, Tom wandered the crowded bazaars and steep ladderways. There were fortune-tellers' booths at the street corners, and shrines to the sky gods, dusty with the crumbly grey ash of incense sticks. Fierce-looking Uyghur acrobats were performing in the central square, and everywhere he looked he saw soldiers and airmen of the League, blonde giants from Spitzbergen, and blue-black warriors from the Mountains of the Moon, the small dark people of the Andean statics, and people the colour of firelight from jungle strongholds in Laos and Annam. He tried to forget that some of these young men and women might soon be dropping rockets on London, and started to enjoy the flow of faces and the incomprehensible mishmash of languages. And sometimes he heard someone say, "Tom!" or "Tomash!" or "Tauma!" as they pointed him out to their friends. The story of his battle with Shrike had spread through the mountains from trading post to trading post, and had been waiting for him here in Bat Munk Gompa. He didn't mind. It felt like a different Thomas that they were talking about, someone brave and strong who understood what had to be done and felt no doubts. He was just wondering if he should go back to the governor's palace and find Hester, when he noticed a tall figure climbing a nearby stairway. The man wore a ragged red robe with the hood pulled down over his face, and carried a staff in one hand and a pack slung over his shoulder. Tom had already seen dozens of these wandering holy men in Bat Munk Gompa, monks in the service of the mountain gods who travelled from city to city through the high passes. Up at the mooring platform, Anna Fang had stooped to kiss the feet of one and given 6 bronze coins for him to bless the Jenny Hanover. But this man was different. Something about him snagged Tom's gaze and would not let it go. He started following the red robe. He followed it through the spice market with its 1,000 astonishing scents, and down the narrow street of weavers, where hundreds of baskets swung from low poles outside the shops like hanging nests, brushing against the top of his head as he passed underneath. What was it about the way the man moved, and that long brown hand clutching the staff? And then, under a lantern in the central square, the monk was stopped by a street girl asking for a blessing, and Tom caught a glimpse of the bearded face inside the hood. He knew that hawk-like nose and those mariner's eyes. He knew that the amulet hanging between the black brows hid the familiar guild mark of a London historian. It was Valentine.
Chapter 27.
Dr. Arkengarth remembers. Catherine spent a lot of time in the museum in those final days as London went roaring toward the mountains. Safe in its dingy maze, she could not hear the burr of the saws as they felled the trees in Circle Park to feed the engines, or the cheers of the noisy crowds who gathered each day in front of the public goggle screens where the details of Crome's great plan were being gradually revealed. She could even forget the Guild of Engineers' security people, who were everywhere now, not just the usual white-coated thugs, but a strange new breed, in black coats and hoods, silent, stiff in their movements, with a faint greenish glow behind their tinted visors. Dr. Twix's resurrected men. But if she was honest with herself, it wasn't only the peace and quiet that kept calling her down to the museum. Bevis was there, his borrowed bedding spread out on the floor of the old transport gallery under the dusty hanging shapes of model gliders and flying machines. She needed his company more and more as the city hauled itself eastward. She liked the fact that he was her secret. She liked his soft voice and the strange laugh that always sounded as if he were trying it on for size, as if he had never had much call for laughter down in the deep gut. She liked the way he looked at her, his dark eyes always lingering on her face, and especially her hair. "I've never really known anybody with hair before," he told her one day. "In the guild, they use chemicals on us when we're first apprenticed, so it never grows back." Catherine thought about his pale, smooth scalp. She liked that too. It sort of suited him. Was this what falling in love was like? Not something big and amazing that you knew about straight away, like in a story, but a slow thing that crept over you in waves until you woke up one day and found that you were head over heels with someone quite unexpected, like an apprentice engineer. She wished that Father were here, so she could ask him. In the afternoons, Bevis would pull on a historian's robe and hide his bald head under a cap and go down to help Dr. Nancarrow, who was busy recataloguing the museum's huge store of paintings and drawings and taking photographs in case the Lord Mayor decided to feed those to the furnaces as well. Then Catherine would wander the museum with Dog at her heels, hunting for the things that her father had dug up. Washing machines, pieces of computer, the rusty ribcage of a Stalker, all had labels that read, "Discovered by Mr. T. Valentine, Archaeologist." She could imagine him lifting them gently out of the soil that had guarded them, cleaning them, wrapping them in scrim for transport back to London. "He must have done the same thing with the Medusa fragment when he discovered it," she thought. She whispered prayers to Cleo, sure that the goddess must be present in these time-soaked halls. "London needs him. I need him. Please send him safely home, and soon." But it was Dog, not Cleo, who led her into the natural history section that evening. He had glimpsed a display of stuffed animals from the far end of the corridor and gone prowling down to stare at them, a growl bubbling in the back of his throat. Old Dr. Arkengarth, who was passing through the gallery on his way home, backed away nervously, but Kate said, "It's all right, Doctor, he's quite safe," and knelt down at Dog's side, looking up at the sharks and dolphins that swung above her, and the great looming shape of the whale, which had been taken off its hawsers and propped against the far wall before the vibrations could bring it crashing down.
"Impressive, isn't it?"
said Arkengarth, who was always ready to begin a lecture.
"A blue whale, hunted to extinction in the first half of the 21st century, or possibly the 20th. The records are unclear. We wouldn't even know what it looked like if Mrs. Shaw hadn't discovered those fossilized bones."
Catherine had been thinking about something else, but the name Shaw made her turn around. The display case Arkengarth was pointing at housed a rack of brownish bones, and propped against a vertebra was a label that said, "Bones of a Blue Whale, discovered by Mrs. P. Shaw, Freelance Archaeologist." Pandora Shore, thought Catherine, recalling the name she had seen in the museum catalogue. Not Hester, of course not. But just to get Dr. Arkengarth out of lecture mode, she said, "Did you know her, Pandora Shaw?"
"Mrs. Shaw? Yes, yes," the old man nodded. "A lovely lady. She was an out-country archaeologist, a friend of your father's. Of course, her name was Ray in those days."
"Pandora Ray?" Catherine knew that name. "Then she was father's assistant on the trip to America. I've seen her picture in his book."
"That's right," said Arkengarth, frowning slightly at the interruption. "An archaeologist, as I said. She specialized in old tech, of course, but she brought us other things when she found them, like these whale bones. Later she married this Shaw chappie and went to live on some grotty little island in the Western Ocean. Poor girl, a tragedy, terrible, terrible."
"She died, didn't she?" said Catherine.
"She was murdered."
Arkengarth waggled his eyebrows dramatically.
6 or 7 years ago, we heard it from another archaeologist, murdered in her own home, and her husband with her, dreadful business. I say, my dear, are you all right? You look as if you've seen a ghost."
But Catherine was not all right. In her mind, all the pieces of the puzzle were flying together. Pandora Shaw was murdered 7 years ago, the same time that Father found the machine. Pandora, the aviatrix, the archaeologist, the woman who had been with him in America when he found the plans of Medusa. And now a girl called Shaw who wants to kill Father. She could hardly manage to force the words out, but at last she asked, "Did she have a child?"
"I think she did. I think she did,"
the old man mused.
"Yes, I remember Mrs. Shaw showing me a picture once when she turned up with some ceramics for my department. Lovely pieces, a decorated vase from the Electric Empire era, best of its kind in the collection."
"Do you remember its name?"
"Oh, ah, yes. Let me see. EE27190, I believe."
"Not the vase, the baby!" Catherine's impatient shout echoed through the gallery and out into the halls beyond, and Dr. Arkengarth looked first startled, then offended.
"Well, really, Miss Valentine, there's no need to snap. How should I remember the child's name? It was 15, 16 years ago, and I have never liked babies. Nasty creatures leak at both ends and have no respect for ceramics. But I believe this particular one was called Hattie, or Holly, or Hester,"
sobbed Catherine, and turned and ran, ran with dog at her heels, ran and ran without knowing where or why, since there was no way that she could outrun the dreadful truth. She knew how Father had come by the key to Medusa, and why he had never spoken of it. At last, she knew why poor Hester Shaw had wanted to kill him. Chapter 28. A Stranger in the Mountains of Heaven. Valentine's hand drew subtle, complicated shapes in the air above the girl's bowed head, and her face was calm and smiling, little suspecting that she was being blessed by the League's worst enemy. Tom watched from behind a shrine to the Sky Goddess. His eyes had known who the red-robed monk was all along, and now his brain caught up with them in a flurry of understandings. Captain Cora had said that the 13th-floor elevator had been haunting the mountains. It must have dropped Valentine off in the crags near Batmunk Gompa, and he had come the rest of the way on foot, creeping into the city like a thief. But why? What secret mission could have brought him here? Tom didn't know what to feel. He was frightened, of course, to be so close to the man who had tried to murder him, but at the same time he was thrilled by Valentine's daring. What courage it must have taken to sneak into the great stronghold of the League under the very noses of London's enemies. It was the sort of adventure that Valentine had written about, in books that Tom had read again and again, huddled under the blankets in the third-class apprentice's dorm with a flashlight, long after lights out. Valentine finished his blessing and moved on. For a few moments, Tom lost sight of him among the crowds in the square, but then he spotted the red robe climbing on up the broad central stairway. He followed at a safe distance, past beggars and guards and hot food vendors, none of whom guessed that the red-robed figure was anything more than one of those crazy holy men. Valentine had his head bowed now, and he climbed quickly, so Tom did not feel in any danger as he hurried along 20 or 30 paces behind. But he still didn't know what he should do. Hester deserved to know that her parents' murderer was here. Should he find her? Tell her? But Valentine must be on some important mission for London, maybe gathering information, so that the engineers would know exactly where to aim Medusa. If Hester killed him, Tom would have betrayed his whole city. He climbed upward, ignoring the pain of his broken ribs. Around him, the terraces of Batmunk Gompa were speckled with lamps and lanterns, and the envelopes of taxi balloons glowed from within as they rose and fell, like strange sea creatures swimming around a coral reef. And slowly he realized that he didn't want Valentine to succeed in whatever he was planning. London was no better than Tunbridge Wells, and this place was old and beautiful. He wouldn't let it be smashed. "It's Valentine!" he shouted, charging up the stairs, trying to warn the passers-by of the danger. But they just stared at him without understanding. And when at last he reached the red-robed man and pulled his hood down, he found the round, startled face of a pilgrim monk blinking back at him. He looked around wildly and saw what had happened. Valentine had taken a different stairway out of the central square, leaving Tom following the wrong red robe. He went running down again. Valentine was barely visible, a red speck climbing through lantern light toward the high places of the city, and the eerie of the great air destroyers. "It's Valentine!" shouted Tom, pointing, but none of the people around him spoke English. Some thought he was mad, others thought he meant that Medusa was about to strike. A wave of panic spread across the square, and soon he heard warning gongs sounding in the densely packed terraces of shops and inns below. His first thought was to find Hester, but he had no idea where to look. Then he ran to a taxi balloon and told the pilot, "Follow that monk!" But the woman smiled and shook her head, not understanding. "Fung Hua!" Tom shouted, remembering Anna Fang's league name, and the taxi pilot nodded and smiled, casting off. He tried to calm himself as the balloon rose. He would find Miss Fang. Miss Fang would know what to do. He remembered how she had trusted him with the Jenny during the flight across the mountains, and felt ashamed for turning on her in the council meeting. He was expecting the taxi to take him to the governor's palace, but instead it landed near the terrace where the Jenny Hanover was berthed. The pilot pointed toward an inn that clung to the underside of the terrace above like a house martin's nest.
"Fung Hua,"
she said helpfully.
"Fung Hua."
For a panic-stricken moment, Tom thought that she had carried him to an inn with the same name as Miss Fang. Then, on one of the establishment's many balconies, he caught sight of the aviatrix's blood-red coat. He thrust all the money he had at the pilot, shouting, "Keep the change!" and left her staring at the unfamiliar faces of Quirk and Chrome as he raced away. Miss Fang was sitting at a balcony table with Captain Cora and the stern young Carolyn flyer who had been so angry at Tom's outburst earlier. They were drinking tea and deep in discussion, but they all leaped up as Tom blundered out onto the balcony.
"Where's Hester?" he demanded.
"Down on the mooring platforms in one of her moods," said Miss Fang.
"Why?"
"Valentine," he gasped. "He's here, dressed as a monk."
The inn's musicians stopped playing, and the sound of the alarm gongs in the lower city came drifting through the open windows.
"Valentine, here," sneered the Carolyn girl.
It's a lie. The barbarian thinks he can frighten us.
Be quiet, Satya. Miss Fang reached across and gripped Tom by the arm.
Is he alone?
As quickly as he could, Tom told her what he had seen. She made a hissing sound through her clenched teeth.
He has come after our air fleet. He means to cripple us.
One man cannot destroy an air fleet, protested Cora, smiling at the notion.
You've never seen Valentine at work, said the aviatrix.
She was already on her feet, excited at the prospect of crossing swords with London's greatest agent.
Satya, go and rouse the guard. Tell them the High Eyries are in danger.
She turned to Tom.
Thank you for warning us, she said gently,
as if she understood the agonizing decision he'd had to make.
I've got to tell Hester, he protested. Certainly not, she told him. She will only get herself killed, or kill Valentine, and I want him kept alive for questioning. Stay here until it is all over.
A last, ferocious smile, and she was gone, down the steps and out of the panicked inn, with Cora at her heels. She looked grim and dangerous and very beautiful, and Tom felt himself brushed by the same fierce love that he knew Cora and the Carolyn girl and the rest of the League must feel for her. But then he thought of Hester, and what she would say when she learned that he had seen Valentine and hadn't even told her.
Great Quirk! He shouted suddenly. I'm going to find her!
Satya just stared at him, not stern anymore, just frightened and very young. And as he ran toward the stairs, he shouted back at her,
You heard what Miss Fang said? Raise the alarm!
Out onto dark ladderways again, down to the mooring platform where the Jenny Hanover hung at anchor.
Hester! Hester!
He shouted. And there she was, coming toward him through the glow of the landing lights, tugging the red shawl up across her face. He told her everything, and she took the news with the cold, silent glare he had expected. Then it was her turn to run, and he was following her up the endless stairs. The wall made its own weather. As Tom and Hester neared the top, the air grew thin and chill, and big fluttering snowflakes brushed their faces like butterfly wings. They could see lantern light on a broad platform ahead, where a gas tanker was lifting away, empty from the High Eyries. Then there was an unbelievable gout of flame shooting out of the face of the wall, and another, as if it were dragons, not airships, that were stabled there. Caught in the blast, the tanker's envelope exploded, white parachutes blossoming around it as it began to fall. Hester stopped for a moment and looked back, flames shining in her eye.
He's done it. We're too late. He's fired their air fleet.
They ran on. Tom's ribs hurt him at every breath, and the cold air scorched his throat. But he kept as close behind Hester as he could, crunching through snow along a narrow walkway to the platform outside the Eyries. The bronze gates stood open, and a crowd of men were pouring out, shielding their faces from the heat of the blaze within. Some of them were dragging wounded comrades, and near the main door, Tom saw Cora being tended by two of the ground crew. The aviator looked up as Tom and Hester ran to him.
Valentine, he groaned. He bluffed his way past the sentries, saying he wanted to bless our airships. He was setting his explosives when Anna and I arrived. Oh, Tom, we never imagined that even a barbarian would try something like this. We weren't prepared. Our whole air fleet, my poor Mokili Mbembe.
He broke off, coughing blood. Valentine's sword had pierced his lung.
What about Miss Fang?
Asked Tom. Cora shook his head. He did not know. Hester was already stalking away into the searing heat of the hangars, ignoring the men who tried to call her back. Tom ran after her. It was like running into an oven. He had an impression of a huge cavern with smaller caverns opening off it, the hangars where the League's warships were housed. Valentine must have gone quickly from one ship to the next, placing phosphorus bombs.
Now only their buckling ribs were visible in the white-hot heart of the blaze.
"Hester!"
shouted Tom, his voice lost in the roar of the flames, and saw her a little way ahead of him, hurrying down a narrow